Hello and welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast,
where we dive into all things digital automation. I'm your host, Nandan Mullakara. While I'm not podcasting, I help people keep up with the fast-changing digital technologies at botnirvana.org. I hope you enjoy the show. Let's get right into it. We have Max Ayofe on our Digital Automation podcast today. Max is the Director for Global Intelligent Automation COE at Wesco. Wesco is a US-based Fortune 500 company with over 18,000 employees globally. In this talk, we discuss the details of Wesco's intelligent automation program and the learnings along the way that you can use to succeed on your automation journey. Let's listen in. Hi, Max Ayofe. Welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast. It's awesome having you today. Can we start with a quick personal intro?
Of course. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here. Hopefully it's going to be a great conversation for you and the listening. My name is Max Ayofe, and I'm Director of Intelligent Automation Center of Excellence for Wesco.
Short and sweet. That's cool. Can you give us a little more background in terms of your intelligent automation journey?
Sure. Our intelligent automation journey started about 5 years ago. My background, I've been with the company for quite a long time, primarily on the supply chain optimization side of things, inventory reporting, dashboarding, analytics, optimizations, mostly on the supply chain. And being in that field, you get a lot of software vendors coming to you saying, hey, take a look at our product, take a look at this, take a look at that. When I was pulled into a demo, software vendors didn't come to me. They came to somebody else in the company to take a look at the RPA product. We looked at it and it really opened my eyes to what we can do with it from multiple angles. One angle was simply the simplicity of building the automation, right? You have something and traditional IT could take quite a bit of time to build. This is a lot faster, a lot easier. You're using the front door, so the validation is much shorter and so forth, right? The other thing that was pretty cool about it is that I've always been sort of in between IT and business. And my IT side always understood how much projects the IT get and how selective they have to be in picking the right project. I've been part of IT intake boards for many years, and I still am. And the amount of projects that go that way is simply insane. There is no way any IT in any organization can possibly handle it. And this was at least looked like a tool that could help us to bridge the gap between IT capacity to deliver and our business needs, especially in an area where the opportunity is a little bit smaller, the impact might be a little bit smaller, yet it is there and it becomes an integral part of the digital transformation. Quite frankly, digital transformation, if we talk about digital transformation in a sense that it touches every desk, cannot be done if you don't touch every desk with your IT improvements. When you do the big things, when you pick up the big rocks in the IT world, a lot of times smaller productivity improvements get left. And that was another thing that brought me to the intelligent automation side. And the third one is really all about the speed of the delivery. And again, I'm not very patient. I don't want to wait to see my idea to become a reality in months or years. And with traditional IT development, staying in line and waiting for development time, it could be the case. Whereas with this, we could do it faster. And also we could step outside of our four walls. Traditional IT, if the process spans between a customer and a supplier, and the distribution industry is all about that, we can optimize everything we want within our walls. And for the functional areas I was responsible for, I think we did a pretty good job of that. But the moment we needed to interact with a supplier that doesn't have ADI or not very reliable ADI partner, that doesn't have a very robust way of integrating with us through other technologies, be it APIs or what have you, we're kind of stuck. Same thing on the customer side. All of a sudden, those walls were removed. We could really use the RPA to web scrape, to integrate the system through the front doors, if you will. And that enhanced the scope of what we can achieve and how fast we can move without waiting for our partners to deliver the results. And last but not least, coming from the inventory and supply chain, if you ever work in supply chain, it will probably echo with you. You can never be right in the supply chain. It's always, you don't have the right product. If you have the right product, it's at the wrong location. If it's right product, right location, it's probably the wrong cost. And the list goes on and on and on. So it's not to say thankless, it's very rewarding to be in a supply chain, but it's a different kind of reward and it's a different kind of environment. Coming to intelligent automation side, you built a robot, you get a lot of thanks for it. And you get those thanks from the leadership team, you get those thanks from the employees. That's a very different story.
Okay. You said some great points there. You know, you've been having exposure both to a business and IT side, which has helped you with this being this intelligent automation leader. From your perspective, did you start with supply chain within Wesco? How did you start your journey?
Like I said, we saw the demo of the intelligent automation technology, and two things became very evident. One, it's a great tool. RPA by itself combined with all the other things that make it intelligent automation is even greater tool. And it's not just a supply chain tool. It's not just a play that we can do in a supply chain. We can make a much bigger play. So we quickly decided to start corporate center of excellence that would govern the entire company intelligent automation system. And as part of that decision, there were a couple of things that I was really trying to achieve right away. And that was, again, that was probably more luck than anything else. But I was trying to figure out, okay, what's the right org structure? How do we build this COE so we get the buy-in from everybody, including IT, including the C-suite, including the business users? And how do we avoid all the pitfalls that a lot of automation program run into? Back in the day, and I think the statistics haven't changed much, if you look at number of automation programs that failed, that number is usually astonishingly high. Goes into 50%+ back in the day. But I started the program 5 years ago. I don't think the numbers have changed, and it just surprises me a lot. There are so many of us talking about it. Your podcast series is a great example of that, and there are many, many others, right? Every automation leader comes in and gives you the recipe how not to fail, and still the failure rate is very high, right? So our secret sauce was us, and it was, again, more of a luck than anything at the moment is, okay, how do we protect ourselves? Well, I need to talk to executives. I need to understand what executives expect from the program. And I need to talk to the IT folks and understand what their concerns are. How do I meet their expectations? How do I meet their needs? And then I needed to figure out what is there for the business, right? How do I go to the business down to the employee level and not come there saying I'm from corporate to kill your job, where that's probably going to be a non-starter. And having some background in the company, having some background in the industry definitely helped. So I was picked to drive the initiative, start the COE, and that's where it all started.
Excellent. You said some great points there in terms of communicating with your executives, with your users, with your business, with your IT, ensuring that everyone is on board before you get started. So now you've got started. What were some initial use cases you did so that you could get this buy-in?
Things unfolded pretty rapidly from multiple locations. One of the things that we did right away, we did a POC with an RPA vendor. And part of that proof of concept was two or three use cases. One of them was an expediting use case that was pretty simple. Let's take all of our open purchase orders and go to a supplier portal who could not pass us the status of those orders and just scrape the data. We're talking about thousands of those open orders with that supplier. And just think about the change in paradigm where historically in a distribution industry where you always have hundreds of thousands of open orders and customer calls you and says, where's my product? And you're saying, that's a good question. Let me expedite it. Let me go to the supplier website. Let me pull the data. That's not very good reflection on your ability to serve the customer, let alone overserve the customer. To shift it to what if we put this bot in play and let this bot scrape the data on a very regular basis, let's say daily. All of a sudden, I can look at the data and say, oh, customer, that purchase order that you placed with us and you needed the product 6 months out, we just talked to the supplier and their latest estimate is that it's going to be 8 months out. Now, customers have plenty of time to react. They can adjust their job schedule. They can maybe talk to us and say, look, I need the product now. All of a sudden, again, the conversation changes from where is my product and you messed up my project, you caused me to fail or you created a lot of stress for me to, I'm helping you to avoid the stress. I'm helping you to give an insight into the supply chain pretty far out and it gives us competitive advantage. It also gives us an ability to overservice the customer and it helps to grow the relationship. It becomes more of a sales opportunity where I'm calling to say, here is where the product is. And the conversation doesn't start with customer being annoyed for us at being late. Long story short, that was one of our early use cases. And there were a couple other about routing automations, optimization for the transportation and a few others. We also started to work with one of our outsourcing partners to see if we can, if they can automate their own processes to make it a little bit faster for us. All of a sudden, my CV became quite busy with a lot of top-down pipeline.
I really like what you said there in terms of what you did initially is not cost savings, which is typically what people go after, but you're talking of customer experience, you know, improving your customer's experience so that they are proactively getting updates. I think that's an awesome use case for any listeners looking to start. I think that's a great place to start, right? What do you think?
Well, you picked up on an interesting point, right? How do you communicate the value of the program? How do you do that? And again, I had very early on conversations with the C-suite and with the CFO directly on what would be the right way to communicate the savings. And that conversation didn't go my way at all, to be honest. I was always of the opinion, or prior to jumping into the program, I thought, well, if I've saved salespeople 10 minutes a day, they can make a couple of sales calls, they can bring us more business. That's a great play to do. And the counter to that was a very fair question. How do you know that 10 minutes a day per person is not spent by the water cooler or spent on taking a longer lunch? And I don't, right? Our program is structured to give business back the time, give business back the productivity, give business back the ability to do more. We can walk the business to the water. We don't really control, in many cases, how the business is using that time. So early on, we had some conversations about what is acceptable form of ROI that I can report and I can be measured on. And we're still using those metrics. I think that's a key to have that continuity and to have that stability. And to your point, the program is not all about hours saved or FTE saved. I never mention FTE saved on any documents. I never look at it that way. And quite honestly, I'm yet to see a single FTE in our organization being removed because of automation. What I see is a lot of FTEs have their jobs slightly redefined or significantly redefined in some cases to do more, to achieve better results. And that's great, but in our case at least, it's not a play where we can say, hey, it's a headcount reduction. At the same time, some of the derivative benefits, we're not reporting them as our achievements. We let the business to report it. And if you think about it, I often talk about it from the ROI standpoint. If we're working with accounts payable, accounts receivable, trying to move the needle on the days to either make them longer or shorter, optimize them, right? I'm usually part of their solution. And typically, whoever is in charge of respective teams is going to say, our goal is to reduce the days or improve the days by X. We were able to achieve it. Are they going to give 100% of credit to my program? Probably not. Is it fair for me to take 100% of that achievement? Most of the times it's not. It's a combination of many, many things, many hours of work, many thoughts of different people, teams, and departments to get that result. So let me take credit for what I impacted directly, and let me be an asterisk on every slide to say, we were able to improve our days. Thank you for the intelligent automation program that actually helped us. That way, from the ROI perspective, we are not double dipping. And frankly, the team that is responsible for the metric is reporting the metric. But at the same time, I am shown as a contributor. I'm shown as a partner. I'm shown a necessary part of that process. And I'm also showing the hours saved that we can verifiably say that we contributed or value created in terms of additional productivity, what have you, where the work was never done before, but the robots are doing that work. Getting back to the expediting example, it's exactly that, right? There is no reason technically why we could not hire a bunch of people to expedite every one of the orders every day. Just not practical to hire that army of people, and it's not cost effective to do it that way. So I'm not necessarily replacing the work. I am creating the productivity for the company. I'm creating the value from the work that was never done before.
Excellent. And so it looks like your businesses are responsible for tracking the metrics. Is that a right understanding?
Well, everybody is responsible. I have my objectives. They are very specific in terms of impact for the organization. I am every one of my objectives, and again, this came from this, we started it in 2019, I've been doing it ever since. Every automation, no matter how big or small, citizen developer or COE design, we want to know why are we doing it and what is the impact. And we want to have a consensus estimate of that impact from a standpoint that a business has to agree on that, I have to agree on that, my IT partners have to agree on that. Why are we doing it from the three ways? Well, it's pretty straightforward and it's pretty to me, it was a little bit counterintuitive when we started. When business comes to me and say, hey, we want to put this automation in place. And if we do, we're going to save 10,000 hours. Why don't we do that? And I look at the size of the team and it's a team of 5 people. And I say, well, if you're truly saving yourself 10,000 hours, that means that your department is going to be shut down, right? You only have that many hours in a year. Something is not connected here. Maybe it's not an hour saved. Maybe it's something else. Let's call it something else. Maybe the estimate is slightly overstated. Let's make it in line so we are realistic about it. And doing that gives me the trust factor from the business, the trust factor from the business leaders, and the trust factor from the CFO organization that whenever I report the numbers, they're pretty darn accurate and they're very consistent and they're verifiable. I can tell the aggregate number of savings down to every individual project contribution. And then that gives us the credibility to talk about the ROI. And one other thing that is interesting about it is, and we started doing it a little bit later in the game, but still fairly early on, is we look at the automation from two lenses. One is, what is the intent? What we were trying to say, right? And the other is, how long is the automation running? What can we pull from the orchestrator, the direct statistics of that automation? Now we can compare the two and say, are they in line? If they're in line, that's great. If for whatever reason I see that we said that the automation is going to save, say, 100 hours, but the statistic shows that it ran for 200 hours in the same period, maybe the workload volume changed. Maybe more transactions got piped to it. But something is often, that's an indication for me to go back and update the hours. And the flip side of it, if we said that this automation is going to save 10,000 hours, and I see that it ran for 20 minutes in the last 30 days, something is not connected again. Let's dive deeper into it, understand why, and get it done. So again, that gives me the infinite amount of credibility that, frankly, I think a lot of the programs in our industry are struggling with to gain. And to me, the credibility means much easier time to argue why I need additional resources. Why do we need to keep growing the program? Why do we need to be a part of digital transformation strategy? And how do we feed into a bigger picture, right? Showing that concrete value, trackable, understandable, verifiable, validatable, whatever adjective you want to put there, makes a big difference.
Yeah. And I think this partnership model is awesome. And I think what you're saying is that the onus is on the business. They are coming and telling you that they need to do this automation. And so they are, you know, tracking their metrics, you are tracking your metrics. So, and then there's a whole communication going on so that, you know, everyone is working towards that same goal, right? And I think that's an awesome model. So and this is a model I've heard from now multiple people, just for the listeners, that wherever the onus is on the business, and there's a pull for an automation. I say this is a pull, but because at many organizations that I worked, you know, there's a push. There's a push from the IT, there's a push from the COE, and trying to push down this automation, its onus is on them to prove that they have saved some hours. And then there's a politics that, oh, okay, no, that's not true. Like you said, the work has changed, and then they say, no, you have not saved so much. And then it becomes a complete political nightmare. So I think as long as the onus is on the business and they want to do the automation, is probably when the organization should be looking to automate. So let's just switch tracks a bit. You did mention about citizen developers, and that's an interesting topic. So can you tell us about your citizen developer program and how that's working?
Absolutely. And I think it's the push-pull is exactly where citizen developers come into play. When you think about citizen developers, let me backtrack. When you think about push-pull to begin with, the biggest problem with the push of the automation, whether it's coming from the corporate or the COE, and I've seen it both ways, the employees being pushed into something that they don't necessarily know, right, Understand, endorse, or want to be a part of. And it's not just the fear of unknown, it's also the fear for the job. It's also the fear for, do I have the skill set to work along the side of the robot? It's also the fear of change in general. It's a lot of fears with the push model. And the other downside to the push model, especially if you're a global center of excellence, I work with every line of business. I can work with sales, I work with operations, I work with supply chain, I work with purchasing, I work with accounting, I work with HR, I work with everybody and anybody. And I'm not an expert in any of those functional areas. I never sold a product. I was never an accountant. I'm not certified. I don't know much about HR operations and so forth, so on. So me trying to push things puts me in a comfortable place where I'm pushing, but I'm not an expert. And a lot of my push comes from with a naive understanding of the industry and the naive understanding of the processes and realities of the business within the company. So very early on, we started with a little bit of a push and a little bit of a pull. And I quickly realized that push is great, but pull is infinitely better. So how do I get the business to pull me in? How do I become a resource for the business as opposite to constantly pushing the business? And that's where citizen developers come into play. So what we started doing, we started the citizen developers program. We started early on, kind of before it became the cool thing to do and before it became the mainstream. And we started on a simple idea. What if I take the business people, well, not programmers, let's get that out of the way right away. The citizen developer is not a programmer. It cannot be sort of your IT resource or a person who knows really well how to program and just happen to work in a business function. No, a citizen developer is a business person who has some passion for technology, have some interest in technology, wants to become a citizen developer. Partially it's with their career development, partially as intellectual curiosity, partially as a desire to make a change, maybe partially out of dislike to what they do today and trying to automate themselves out of something they don't like. Those are the people we are after. It's not about the technical skill set, it's just that. And then what we try to do, we try to give them the training. We train them on a couple of things. One is, what is this thing is all about? Making sure that folks understand to begin with that intelligent automation, at least for our company, is not a headcount play. It's not a play to replace people with robots. It's not a play to create additional work for anybody. It's a play to automate the existing body of work and prepare ourselves as part of the digital transformation for new work that will be coming our way, or we already see it coming our way, but we are unable to take it. It's about competitive advantage with the customers and suppliers, where we can do more with less. That's how we frame the program. And then what we start doing is we try to teach citizen developers what is an automatable process. We spend a lot of time on what is the complexity, what is the simplicity in the automation world, what is the suitability, what is suitable, what is not suitable. And then we do train them how to program their own automation, but we don't have a very significant emphasis on turning an accountant, a trained CPA accountant, to become a programmer. Unrealistic, not going to happen. Let's not waste our time there. Let's just train them to understand that, hey, this can be automated. Part of the program is that every citizen developer has to come up with a process they want to automate. Part of that effort is also as they come up with a process, they try to automate it as far as they can. But again, I'm very realistic about citizen developers' time commitments. They are business resources. We're working on their borrowed time, if you will, right? So we build the program with an assumption that yes, some people, it's based, well, there is a weekly webinar that is kind of required for folks, but beyond that, it's self-paced. And if somebody hasn't done anything for a couple of weeks because there's a major project in their department, if all of my folks from accounting and finance are not available first week of the month because they're trying to close the book, understand it. That's just the reality of the business. We accommodate for it. And then the citizen developers build whatever they propose to the point that they can. And then my professional team picks it up and does the development. We have about 200 citizen developers, and all of them are at very different points of their technology awareness and journey, but all of them are our ambassadors into the business. They're the folks who can help us, with the pipeline, who can answer the questions, who can bring us the ideas, so we can automate them. That changes. It's a long answer to the question about push-pull, but that really changes things from the push from the corporate to bring automation to who from the field, no matter how low or high in the organization you are, bring me the automation. And yeah. I'm there to facilitate.
Yeah. And I think that's a subtle but a big shift in the organization, right? Because there now is people, your ambassadors all around. You said 200 of them all around giving you ideas, looking to automate their work. And they are, you know, basically you are helping them. It's not you trying to push something to them. So now this is mentioned 200 citizen developers. How many developers do you have supporting them? And you know, and also how do you get them to do their work? Just like you mentioned, achieve your objectives because they are busy with their work. So 200 of them, how many of them here, and how do you get your automations done?
Well, it's not nearly as complicated as it sounds. As far as the expectation to the citizen developers, safety is in the numbers. I cannot say that there are 200 people constantly working on building automation. That's definitely not the case. But what I see is I would see citizen developers who went dormant on me for 2 years maybe.
Okay.
And then they reappear, and I can share a quick success story here. I had a citizen developer from the audit department, internal audit, that they automated something in their own functional area, which is great. And then he disappeared from me. And all of the sudden, quite a while later, they reached out and said, hey, we're auditing a process somewhere in Latin America. And that process seems extremely manual. It's extremely tedious. They can really benefit from the automation. Can you take a look? Can we will connect you with the right person. Can you really try to figure it out? So that's an example of citizen developer who built only one automation, but gave me a pipeline and thought of me somewhere in a situation where I would have no clue that that business problem exists. It was one of those departments that not necessarily comes up on my radar all the time. So that's one thing about citizen developers. Another thing to the same point is that the biggest motivation for citizen developers is really picking the project that they feel passionate about. And if they're passionate about the project, one way or another, they will find time to push it forward. And at some cases, I do have citizen developers who come back to me saying, you know what? I'm really passionate about it. I tried it. I tried to build it. I just don't have time. I want to do it. I will maybe do it later, but right now it's just not in the cards for me. That's okay. Let me build the automation for you. Again, they become the ambassador, the pipeline generators, but we still build the right thing for the business. And I'm sure we'll touch on change management somewhere, somehow. Those conversations always go in that area. But that's where the change management all of a sudden becomes super easy. Somebody wants the change. Somebody drives the change. I'm just there to help them with the change. And then between all those different things, it becomes very easy to support citizen developers. And I'm, you know, there's nagging, there are office hours. I have 1 hour a week allocated to office hours, open door, open Teams meeting. Anybody who has a problem can come in. Sometimes I have 10 people there. Sometimes I have two, sometimes I have zero. And that's okay. I know that citizen developers are aware how to get a hold of me if they need to. And then as far as support, again, our model might be a little bit less traditional. We take the automation from citizen developers when they say it's done, and we put it into the orchestration and we change the code in the process so it is enterprise grade ready. Use of system accounts, error handling, frameworks, all that good stuff that makes the difference between what citizens can realistically do and what enterprise IT wants us to be doing. We take care of that. We put it into production. Any individual automation doesn't take that long to go through that transformation. But what we achieve from that is we have every one of those processes documented. We have every one of those processes with the source code that is known to us. And we have every one of those processes running by professional teams. So whenever it's failed, it's not dependent on the citizen developer. And also very early on was probably more of a chance we ran into an orphan automation scenario. Somebody left the company and they built an automation and was great automation, but as they build it, they knew that they were leaving. So they told us, hey guys, you need to do something about it. That got me thinking, that got me to go back to my prior lives in supply chain. And I think everybody in IT or anybody in supply chain has a story about somebody building an Excel spreadsheet, an Access database, a bunch of macros that do some extremely critical business process. and all of a sudden nobody understands how it's done, nobody understands when it's done, why it's done, that person leaves and it becomes a huge liability for the team and the department to deal with that. Well, by taking automations from the citizen developers, and when you have 200 figure on, you know, 5-10% attrition, that's still significant number of folks that will leave every month or every year, we are able to move on and not lose any of those automations. So that's our model. It does not take a lot of developers. It's less than one full-time person doing, you know, all the citizen developer stuff, with me doing the office hours. We, again, with the help of a professional developer, because sadly, the more I am in the management, the less comfortable I am giving technical advice.
Okay. And how do you support these bots, which are now in production?
Support was a sore, I mean, that's a great question. Support was a sore point for me about a year, year and a half ago, where we grew pretty quickly and we could not figure out the right model for the support. And then I was fortunate to get somebody on my team who was able to open my eyes to how support should be done. He's a developer who came in and said, why don't we write a robot that monitors the status of the orchestrator instead of people doing that? And why don't we have a robot that restarts the automations that are can be restarted? And why don't we have the config file that tells us what to do with the automation when it fails? So all of a sudden, a fair amount of support got automated just from that. And the workload of the developers team changed from maybe an hour or two every day on support, which I really did not like a single bit for, when everybody is working on new development for 6 hours, 5 hours a day. That's just not great, right? To back to the normal amount. Yes, we still have support. If it's a simple restart, the robot will take care of that. If it's more complicated, developer who developed the automation, if they're still with us, is going to be having the pleasure to deal with their own problems. That I think that motivates people to build better code, but also just easier. And then the automation goes into what we call hypercare mode. It stays there for a couple of days. We make sure that it's stable again, and we kick it back into production. That helped having those automations and, frankly, bringing a little bit more tight coding standards and expectations what the program cannot do as far as reusable components, as far as how clear the code is, made all the difference. So now we're in a place where just today we had our daily status call and I said, hey, any updates from support? And there was silence. Nobody had anything to talk about. And I love that.
Yeah. I mean, when you're automating and proactively taking steps, I think that that really helps, right? So is that a separate team? It looks like it's the same team doing everything, right?
Same team, right. We toyed around with a separate team. And one of the things that I could not reconcile with is the fact that the separate team where I talked to my peers, I looked at the examples, they're really good at restarting the robot and doing the very basic troubleshooting. Some of that was automated. Some of that is still falling on people. But if you think about the user experience, and maybe to digress a little bit, when you think about bots, I think of bots as digital workers. And with digital workers comes the responsibility that if your physical worker doesn't show up to work quite often, what do you do? If your physical worker is inconsistent in the results, makes a lot of errors, doesn't finish the processes, what do you do? Well, the digital worker should be treated the same way. If my bot is not reliable, it will be fired. My utilization will take a big hit, or most likely than not, the process will change to kick the bot from out of that process. Same thing can happen when you do the robot and that robot is just not consistently executing to the script. So we realize that a dedicated support team will not be able to help us to keep those metrics. They would escalate a lot of things to the developers. By the time developers look at it, too late, and we get away from it. And it seems to be working just fine. I do have a geographically diverse team, which gives me more time zone coverage. But beyond that, it's all the same people building bots, supporting bots, and doing everything else.
Excellent. So this was a great conversation, Max Ioffe. Before we go, which is a good place for people to find you?
LinkedIn is always easy. I'm Maxim Ioffe on LinkedIn, so just hit me there and I will be more than happy to connect.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Ioffe. I'll leave a link to your LinkedIn profile. So thank you so much for taking time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Nandan. It's my pleasure. It's great to have a conversation with you.
Thank you for joining the Bot Nirvana podcast. Appreciate if you can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you're consuming your podcast. Catch the show notes on botnirvana.org. While you are there, feel free to explore more free digital automation resources and more. See you next time.